Mormon Expression Voices is sponsored by Sunstone Magazine. For nearly four decades, Sunstone has been at the forefront of progressive Mormon scholarship, art, and letters. Subscribe to Sunstone on your iPad, Android, or Kindle, and have it delivered automatically 6 times per year for only $12.99. And for a limited time, Sunstone is offering Voices podcast listeners a special offer, a 20% discount off the annual price of a new print subscription. Visit sunstonemagazine.com today and use promo code VOICES.
My heart has no words. My eyes have no tears left. Mind had done gone crazy when off and married my fears. Now I'm standing here with nothing left to tell you. I'm standing here with nothing to prove. I got nothing to prove.
Welcome to Mormon Expression Voices. As always, this is Heather, and today I am conducting an interview with fellow Mormon expositor podcaster Clay and his wife Holly. Hello, guys.
Hello.
So in true Mormon Expression Voices fashion, let's just go ahead and just dive right in and start talking about Mormon childhood or how you became associated with Mormonism. Were both of you lifelong Mormons?
Yes.
Born in the church?
Yeah, both of us born and raised in the church.
Okay. Who wants to start off telling me what it was like being a Mormon kid?
I'll start off. I was born, I'm the eighth child out of nine. We were a pretty big Mormon family. My dad was a convert to the church after he married my mom, and my mom has been a member her whole life, but she said that when she was younger, they didn't emphasize getting married in the temple. So she didn't find it as a problem to get married in the temple. But I was born in a big family, and we were expected to go to church every Sunday, and we had family prayer at 9 o'clock every night, and we talked about our week, and I had to go to Mutual on Wednesday, and I was really, really faithful all growing up, and I didn't want to disappoint anyone, and I was just a good little girl, just trying to do everything I was supposed to do.
So your father joined after your parents got married?
Right.
Did they go through the temple at any point?
They did after 4 years. Well, they got, yeah.
Oh,
my dad
so...
got baptized 4 years after they were married.
Okay. So then you weren't around to go to the temple as a child then?
No, uh-uh.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So faithful family, and you were even faithful in so much as family prayer. I know a lot of members who... yeah, they went to church on Sunday, had to go to Mutual, but never family prayer, never scripture study, never family home evening. So
yeah, we didn't have to do, well, we didn't do family home evening. Like every year we tried to start it up, but we never could finish it. There's just too many of it, us and too many schedules to wrap around. And
okay. And did you grow up in a heavily Mormon area, or did you grow up somewhere that there were fewer Mormons?
I grew up in Oregon. It was pretty heavily Mormon. There is four wards in a pretty small town and a branch. And so there's quite a bit of members in that town.
Okay. So you didn't feel like it made you different in your culture then? It was pretty normal to be Mormon?
Well, actually, like, everyone was a Mormon. And then it was pretty bad. In high school, I figured out that, like, this boy wasn't Mormon. And I was like, what? You're not Mormon? I was like, okay, well, I guess I can't like you then. It's kind of silly. I was one of those silly, silly Mormons, so.
Okay. And how about you, Clay? How was your childhood as a Mormon?
Yeah, I mean, I was born and raised in the church, and my family was definitely devout. I grew up in north central New Mexico, so I was removed from, you know, Utah, Mormonism. My parents are from Utah. But at the same time, there was a decent amount of Mormons in the community in Los Alamos, New Mexico. And my family was pretty typical, very devout. We did have family home evening every week. We had family prayer. We tried to have family scripture study at various times in my childhood. And sometimes it would work and sometimes it wouldn't. You know, I'm the second oldest. And growing up as a young kid, I was definitely very Mormon. As an adult, both my younger siblings and myself are now not affiliated with the church, and my older sibling is still LDS, but I would label her as somewhat of a liberal, moderate Mormon, I guess, is how I would describe her. As a teenager, though, I went through a phase where I definitely did not consider myself Mormon, though. I don't know, I was a pretty rebellious teenager and tried to reject the church and kind of create my own identity.
Well, I remember you saying on some podcast that we've done that you grew up in a really, well, you grew up in a very scientific area of the country in Los Alamos.
Yeah.
Am I remembering correctly that you didn't have a problem with putting science and religion together with Mormonism?
Well, I definitely tried to, I think, as a kid. Mm. And you're right in that Los Alamos is kind of a unique area. The National Laboratory's there, and there are a lot of people with really high degrees there. You know, I know there were people in my ward that openly advocated evolution when I was growing up, and maybe a little bit more of a progressive thought. I remember as a kid trying to meld science and religion a couple times. I think it was tolerated within my household, but not necessarily welcome. For example, in high school, I remember reading the book Ishmael by Daniel Quinn. He starts talking about how Cain and Abel may have been an allegory between hunter-gatherer civilizations and farming and agriculture civilizations, and kind of the split of philosophy. And I remember trying to bring that up at the dinner table one time. You know, both my parents just kind of raised their eyebrows at me and assured, you know, wanted to make sure that I was just thinking that this was just kind of a cool idea and not really believing it. So they were tolerant, but they weren't really necessarily encouraging of that. You know, I think I grew up fairly questioning. You know, I tried to read the Book of Mormon at one time when I was a kid, and I read 2 Nephi and starting reading about how God is blatantly condoning the genocide of the Indians there, and started talking about that at the dinner table. And I think my dad said something along the lines of, well, you know, some people say 2 Nephi is pretty hard to get through, so, you know, you can skip that if you want to skip it or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, I think that I grew up in a town and a family that probably fostered more progressive thinking than some, but my family was definitely still conventional believers.
So, Holly, you said that you were a faithful believer all the way through childhood. Did that continue into your teenage years?
Yeah, I tried to do everything I was told when I was a child. I would read the Book of Mormon, and I would think that it was more of a story. I wouldn't even go to the point where it wasn't real. Like, it was just like, I have to have faith in all of this, or it would just ruin so many lives kind of thing. So, huh. And I just wanted to be just the best child there was, I guess. I guess that comes from being, like, the youngest in the family, I guess, but I don't know.
I think you're around my age. Did you have the young women's, like, what was that called? Personal progress?
Yes.
Did you do personal progress?
I did, and my mom was my teacher all throughout young women's, and so I got it all done. She'd interview me and everything. So
did you enjoy the young women's program, or was it more of just that I want to be a good kid, I want to please my family, this is what I should do?
You know, I really did like mutual. There was times where it dealt more with girly things, and I was more of a tomboyish kind of girl, I guess, in high school. It was kind of annoying at times to go to mutual and always having to do like sewing projects and stuff, which is sad because now I'm like a big sewer. So I guess I can thank them for something, you know.
All right, Clay. So why don't you tell me about the rebellion that you went through in your teenage years?
I can't really label a certain circumstance that initiated that rebellion, but I always kind of felt the draw to explore and create my own individuality and identify with interesting people and stuff. And so in my early teenage years, you know, I started to experiment with drugs and started to openly rebel against religion and play with other religious ideas. And yeah, I was just, you know, an all-around rebellious kid. And within my ward in New Mexico, I was definitely labeled as one of the kids that was a bad influence on other kids. And that was kind of hurtful to me as a kid because I was openly blamed and my parents were blamed for rebellious choices that other people's kids were making. And so, like, I had parents tell their kids that they didn't want, you know, their kids to hang out with me because I was influencing them to do bad choices, which was bizarre because as a kid, I was abnormally paranoid about influencing others to make choices. You know, I remember as a kid lighting up a joint and there'd be other people there and I'd be like, now listen, if there's anything in you that you're, you know, not sure about and you don't want to do it, then don't smoke this weed, you know? And they would anyway, but then I'd get blamed for making other people's choices. And there's a lot of people that go with a rebellious period and then still just kind of go along with the church. And I think that I did that for some time, but at the same time, I really tried to separate myself from the church kind of steps of progression in that when I turned 16 and I was eligible to be ordained a priest, I declined the opportunity. You know, I said, I don't want to do this. It's not my thing. You know, I remember as a freshman, I got in an open yelling match with my freshman seminary teacher because he said that God doesn't withhold blessings from people, but people withhold blessings from themselves. And I brought up the blacks and the priesthood. And we went head to head and ended up attending the sophomore seminary class the rest of the year because of the confrontation. And so there were just a lot of things going on. You know, I was a rebellious kid. I don't think my rebellion was that intellectual by any means. I was just a rebellious kid and was interesting in kind of finding myself.
Okay, so you were rebelling against like the strictures of behavioral codes and
yeah, mostly.
And traditional ideas of how you should behave.
Yeah.
Being a good kid. So how aware were your parents of exactly what you were up to? Did they know that you were involved in drugs and that kind of thing?
Yeah, they definitely knew. You know, I'd get grounded a lot because they'd find alcohol or drugs in my room.
And did they ever try to bring the church into that? Did they ever make you go talk to the bishop and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I remember having conversations with them. I don't know if they ever suggested that I go talk to the bishop, but I think at one time we had a conversation where they suggested that I not take the sacrament.
How about?
I mean, there were a lot of conversations, but I don't remember anything specific.
Didn't they have your parents call the other kids' parents after a party or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, my parents were very conscientious of this whole not influencing other people, mm-hmm. and I threw at a party at our house once, and my parents found out and called all the other parents and told them that there was alcohol at their house without them knowing and that they were extremely sorry or something.
I'm always kind of interested in the way that parents will abdicate their authority in parenting to some accountant in their ward who just so happened to get the label bishop, you know? All of a sudden that person has some sort of special insight in how you should handle what's going on with your kids. So I was just curious if that had, you know, but played a factor. Did you involve yourself? I know you said you declined, you know, joining the next rank in priesthood, but did you ever deal with like passing the sacrament when you knew you weren't worthy and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. And it wasn't a pleasant experience at all. I mean, I dealt with teenage guilt throughout my teenage years, probably more to do with things like masturbation than drugs and alcohol for some reason, oddly. But because, I mean, that's next to murder, right? And drugs and alcohol aren't next to murder.
Yeah, pale in comparison.
That's right. So, I mean, I definitely, I felt terrible a lot of my childhood and really struggled with guilt issues. And
I would have to say likewise. Struggled with guilt throughout my whole childhood and teenage years.
And didn't you say, Holly, you think maybe your outward devotion, how eager you were in your outward devotion may have reflected that?
I tried to be a really good Mormon outwardly because I didn't feel like I fit the norm inside, I guess.
Yeah, with worthiness and whatnot.
Yeah.
Did either of you guys go on missions?
Yeah, I went on a mission.
Yeah.
And did you, Holly?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
I actually approached the topic with my mom, and she just looked at me and said, really? You really want to go on a mission? That's not for you.
Wow.
Yeah. She knew me better than I knew myself, I guess.
Okay. So, Clay, did you always think there'll come a point when I'll clean up and go on a mission, or did it dawn on you later that you wanted to do that?
Yeah, not at all. I mean, I actually remembered one of my friends. Interestingly, most of my non-LDS friends were probably much more level-headed and mature about things like substance abuse and things like that or experimentation than I was. But I remember another LDS friend that also was fairly rebellious. And at one point, he kind of cleaned up, and he told me, like, oh, I always, you know, assumed that I was going to clean up, and that just boggled my mind. But no, I didn't always think that I was going to kind of fit into the Mormon mold. But when I was 16, I went to EFY. And I'm always embarrassed to say that I had it at EFY, but I had this knockdown, drag out, in your face, ground shaking, born again experience. It was that born again experience that I said, hey, I need to, like, oh, God loves me. I need to clean up and start being Mormon.
Can you describe the born again experience? What happened?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to explain because obviously I interpret that experience differently now.
Yeah.
As an atheist, but the experience was very real and very life-changing regardless of the source, I guess. And actually, in the grand scheme of things, I actually still view it as a positive experience, even though I think I interpreted it poorly. But anyway, I mean, we were at EFY. It was like a long week. You know, you get all pumped up with Mormon music, and, you know, EFY is a pretty intense experience. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's a pretty aggressive experience, I guess. And I remember near one of the last days, there was this kind of final conference, and we were singing, and everybody was singing. This is going to sound incredible. I am cautious in explaining this because I know how bizarre and hokey this sounds. The closest I can come to describing it is I felt like, you know, they describe God's voice as kind of the rushing of great winds and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I felt that through my body. There were winds in my body, and I felt an overwhelming sense of love and acceptance, which was an amazingly beautiful experience for me because throughout my life, even when I was more obedient, I've always felt kind of an overwhelming sense of judgment and criticism in my family. And I know my parents probably don't mean to do that, but I think a lot of us kids in our family feel that way. But anyway, I felt an overwhelming sense of love and acceptance and desire to live up, to live better, I guess. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's the best. And I cried uncontrollably, more uncontrollably than I have many times in my life. Yeah.
He's a softie, though, so he cries quite a bit.
It's true. I do cry at corny movies, but this was an uncontrollable weeping. And that's the best I can come to describe it. I don't know.
Okay. And so that was definitely labeled a spiritual experience for you, and it confirmed that the church was true and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And that's problematic because now I look back at that experience and I recognize that I interpreted that experience within the framework that I was in. But later on, I remember talking to a friend that's incredibly intellectual and incredibly bright, and I told him about this experience, and he didn't belittle the experience at all, but he said, and Clay, what did you learn from that experience? And I couldn't really put my finger in on anything. It's not like that experience told me to believe in Mormonism. The experience just felt incredibly good, and I feel like I interpreted that within the framework of Mormonism, if that makes sense.
Oh, definitely. It lived up to what you were told you will experience, and so when you experience something like that, it automatically gets labeled confirmation.
Yeah.
So then after that point at 16, were you a upstanding Mormon kid, decided to go on a mission at 19 and all that?
Pretty much. I mean, I came home, I abandoned my rebellious ways, and then for a time, I decided, you know, smoking weed was just too much fun, so I played around with it for a little bit more. But then at some point I said, like, hey, Clay, you have this experience. If you want to get serious about things, you've got to be serious. You can't just, like, 2 weeks before your mission go in and go on your mission. So the end of my junior year in high school, I swore sobriety, was a upstanding Mormon throughout my senior year and my freshman year of college, and then went on a mission.
Okay, and where'd you go on your mission?
I went to Venezuela.
Oh, nice. Did you enjoy it?
I loved Venezuela, and I ate up the culture.
And the food. And,
the food was great, the people were great, the language was great, the country was beautiful, and there were certain aspects of the mission that were beautiful as well, and then there were certain aspects that were incredibly difficult and trying at the same time. So,
and were those spiritual things, or were those like regulations and behavioral expectations and things like that?
No, the behavioral stuff didn't bother me too much. I mean, I understand people's resentment to being treated like a child. Mm-hmm. And in retrospect, I don't like that. But they were more spiritual things in the sense that, you know, we were told that if we're not baptizing, then we are not working effectively. Then you feel that if you're not baptizing, you're not doing a good job. You
and
know?
So you push yourself harder and harder. And
yeah, and just feeling like, oh, well, it may be a internal worthiness issue. There was another time that I feel was incredibly faith trying. And I was in this one area, and as missionaries, we were all going on a hike. And some of the wanted to go on a hike with us. And the young men leader that was 18, I believe, was going to go as well. But the morning of that hike, the young men's leader didn't show up. So all these young men went on this hike with us. And one of the kids ended up falling and dying on that hike. And that kind of rocked my world within the mission, in the sense of why did that happen, in the sense that I had these fantasies when this horrible experience was taking place of this kid walking out of the woods unscathed, like a New Testament miracle. But no, you know, that boy was dead, and we had to go back and tell his parents that he was dead. And so that was pretty tough. And there were other minor things that were pretty tough as well. You know, just leadership things. Mm-hmm. The mission president telling us to do one thing and us taking it as inspiration. And then a month later, him giving me a wink, wink, nod, nod. Well, Clay, you're smart enough to know that actually that's not really the case. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. Like, you told us a month ago that it was, and right. And we're eating what you're saying up as revelation, and you're letting us down. And so there were incredibly amazing things about the mission, but incredibly almost traumatizing things about the mission as well.
Okay. And when you went into that experience, did you feel like you were knowledgeable about the church, had a good testimony?
I felt like I had a good testimony, but I felt incredibly unworthy. And I felt like I was going out of obedience, but not necessarily that I was adequate.
And how about coming out? Did you come out with a firm testimony and felt like you were a solid member of the church?
Yeah, definitely. I came out feeling strong. I mean, there were definitely things that were faith trying, but by no means did I lose my testimony during my mission or anything like that.
At what age did you and Holly meet and start dating?
Do you want to take this one over?
I can't remember what age we met.
Well, we were like 21 or something. 21, 22.
Can't remember.
We both went to BYU Idaho.
Yeah.
After the mission.
I was there 2 years before I met him. I actually have a good story. The first time I saw him, I thought, he's good looking, but I'm going to make him run for his money kind of thing.
Then we ended up getting married at 20. We were 23 when we got married.
Yeah. We started dating.
I don't know. We were friends for a good long time. And then we started dating when we were about probably 22. And then we dated for a year and got married like a year and a half later or something.
Leading up to that time, Holly, did you always think I'm going to go to a church school, or how did you end up at BYU Idaho?
You know, BYU Idaho was the only school I applied to, and for some reason I was like, I'm going to get in. It's just where I'm going to be. So I remember praying one night and saying, I need to get into the school because it's the only school that I applied to, and I got in. So.
And did you go there with the intention of I want to get married to a returned missionary in the temple? Like, did you have all those ideals laid out for yourself beforehand?
Oh, yeah. I was one of those girls that was like, I'm going to get married within the first year. I'm going to have lots of babies, and I'm going to just be glorified.
Okay.
But, yeah, that didn't turn out because it took me a while to get married. And at 21, I had to think about the mission, and that didn't turn out.
And at BYU Idaho, 21's old.
That's what I was going to say. Old. So you were a 21-year-old old maid, right?
I was really, yeah, I felt old maid. And I was like, I was really kind of depressed about it a little bit, you know, and I'd cry and I'd be like, oh, why aren't I married? I should be married right now. And I remember praying a lot about it. And then I was like, forget that. I'm going to have fun. And so then the next year, I just had tons of fun with my roommates. We'd pull pranks and just have lots of fun with our ward. But
I mean, you kind of took it personally in the sense that you felt like not getting married was a reflection on your own worth or worthiness, no?
Yeah, I felt like I wasn't worthy enough to be married, so I just kind of ran with dealing with myself, I guess, after that.
So yeah. was it a matter of you were committing small sins, or it was just an inherent, oh, I'm not spiritual enough, I don't read my scriptures enough, or that kind of thing?
Well, that they're both things as well. Like I'd like to say back then I was struggling a lot with masturbation, but I always felt really guilty about that, and so I actually told my bishop at school, and he told me that I was forgiven. And I remember after that I felt forgiven, and I felt worthy, and I felt.
But you also felt like you were like the only person.
Yeah, I felt like I was the only girl, because they never talk about girls doing it. They always talked about boys. And I was like, I am the worst girl in the world if I am the only one who ever does it. So it was horrible.
I basically had the same exact experience in college.
Yeah.
So yeah. Because the church has a very Victorian view, women are not sexual beings at all.
Right, exactly. So. And then I felt like all the people, all the higher up men could read my mind. And I was just like, covering myself, like cowering in front of them. And then like, I try to act really, really religious to counteract it.
Okay. This might not be a question that you can answer, but when you were in that phase of feeling bad about not being married and feeling like it was a reflection upon yourself, if you had met Clay at that moment, do you think you would have jumped into marrying him a lot sooner than you did when you did meet him?
No, I don't think so.
You don't think so?
Well, I think, that's not true. Because when we started dating, I was like, I wanted him to ask me to marry him, like, within the first couple of months. And, like, he never did. And I was like, why isn't he asking me to marry him? Like, this is ridiculous. And then after 7 months, he asked me to marry him. But to answer your question, I think any time before that, I would have been fine with getting married. Okay. I just wanted to get married, I guess. That's kind of silly.
No, I think it's normal for young girls to want to get married, and it's a culture we came from. Seems like you dated for a fairly reasonable amount of time. I mean, I've interviewed people who were married within like 4 months of knowing each other.
Well, it was all because of Clay. It's not. It wasn't because of me. I would have gotten married fast.
Clay, is that because you were like, it's unreasonable to get married to somebody that I don't know? Or was it more like, hey, I'm young and having fun and I don't want to settle down?
No, it's just more terrifying than anything. I mean, at first we liked each other and then we loved each other and everything was good, but...
Which I told him I loved him first.
I guess I just felt I just felt like it was a huge deal, you know, and I do feel like I was a little bit I saw a lot of people around me starting dating and getting married extremely rapidly, and by all means that works for a lot of people, and it's worked for people very close to me, but it just boggled my mind. I couldn't wrap my head around that. Mm-hmm. So it's just more me terrified and wanted to make sure that, you know, that things were good and we were serious, I guess.
So eventually you guys get engaged and decide to get married, and I'm assuming temple marriage was just the default.
We got married in the Portland temple.
Yeah.
So tell me about your experiences in the temple then, when you went through for the first time, each of you.
I went through a week before I got married. Was it a week or 2 weeks? I can't remember.
Yeah.
And it was... I just remember just trying to take it all in. I wasn't overwhelmed by it all, but I just tried to act like I was the good little girl. And I remember looking at Clay throughout the ceremony, and he had this big smile on his face, and he looked at me, and I just was like, I'm doing the right thing. So that's what I felt. Good. Like I was doing the right thing, I guess.
So you focused on that more than what the ceremonies entailed?
Yeah, I think that's what I... really thought.
So what year did you guys go through, or what year did you guys get married?
2004.
2004. Mm-hmm. So was that at the point when they started just touching the forehead, or?
No, it was before then.
Was before that. And so none of that bothered you?
Well, hold on. Let's think about this.
It was right after when I went through. So they didn't go through the whole, I don't know what they did before, but.
Yeah.
They just
touched your forehead.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, that's a little less weird than what had happened. But what about, did you put any thought into them making you veil your face or any of those types of things? Did they bug you?
No, I actually thought it was kind of special. Just kind of, and I had the inside secret to the religion, I guess.
So it wasn't traumatic then?
No, uh-uh.
Well, that's good, because I think it can ruin a lot of gals' weddings. So how about you, Clay? What was your, I'm assuming you went through right before your mission.
Yeah, I went right before my mission, and I loved it. Yeah, I hear a lot of people that have serious problems with the temple, and I can understand that, but I don't share that experience. And it's not because I think the temple necessarily means anything special, but I think I just have a quirky personality where I love liturgy and ritual. I got caught up in that. And I was aware of similarities between the Masonic ceremonies and the temple ceremony. I guess I wasn't aware of quite as much blatant plagiarism as there is, but I was kind of aware of that. And I went, you know, I went when they still touched different body parts and stuff, and I was down. I was actually disappointed when they made that change. But having said that, I should give a caveat that in my college ward, right before I went on my mission, my branch president, he was incredibly explicit in what was going to happen. And so I didn't get there with many surprises. I knew pretty much what to expect. He pretty much walked me through the entire ceremony without actually saying the words that were in the ceremony, which I thought was probably wise on his part if he was to kind of control the fallout that he would deal with, you know, with people going through and being surprised the first time through.
Yeah, temple terrified me. So I kind of, and I never went as a believer, so I live vicariously through asking everybody. All right, so you guys got married in 2004. How many years were you married before Mormonism started unraveling? How many years did you have of just normal Mormon marriage?
About 3 years.
3 years, okay.
Yeah. 2.5 to 3 years.
It was right before my first daughter was
born in 2007.
And then he addressed me after she was born.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's talk about that phase before then, though. Was it just coasting? How did you guys feel about the church? Were you active? How'd all that work out?
We were very active. I mean, we even, when we lived in Rexburg, we went to the temple every month, mm-hmm. and then we tried to go every month when we moved to other places, but just didn't work out. But we would do our callings, and we...
Did you try to recreate the similar Mormon families you'd grown up in with family home evening and prayer and all that?
Yeah.
Well, we didn't have that growing up, so we did a little bit of that, didn't we?
But when we were married, we did family home evening and we did prayer. We wouldn't do scripture study, but we would do family home evening and prayer.
Okay. No, and actually Hinckley told us to read the Book of Mormon within the month or something, and I took that challenge and you didn't, and I was like, why isn't he taking this challenge? It's so weird. Well, he was also going to school, but
okay. And have you guys lived in several places or just Rexburg?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we were married in Rexburg, and then we've lived all over the place. We lived in New Mexico for about 8 months between undergraduate and graduate school, and then we lived in Wyoming. And now we live in Arizona.
And then in between Wyoming, we lived in Denver.
Lived in Denver and Houston for short periods of time as well.
Yeah. And that was all related to your graduate work, right, Clay?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
All right. So how many children do you guys have?
We have two.
Two.
A girl and a boy.
A girl and a boy. Okay. So is your daughter the oldest?
She is, yeah.
So she was just a baby when Clay came to you and...
Yes.
Okay, so Clay, tell me what had led up to that. What was going on that was making things unravel?
Yeah, so not to be boring and rewind, but I think it really started at BYU Idaho when, even though I was devout and active at BYU Idaho, you know, I was getting my degree in geology, and that was faith trying in that I had to, we got so comfortable within geology with throwing out huge amounts of prophetic edict. We were convinced and learned and taught evolution, and we knew the age of the earth, and we knew that Noah's flood didn't happen. And we knew, you know, that all these, you know, that there was death before Adam. We knew about pre-Adamites, early humans, and also just the very setup of the scientific method and understanding the world through observation and things like that. And so at some point, you know, I became a little bit troubled with that. I can't exactly say when, but I'm comfortable with throwing away such big amounts of Mormonism. Where do I draw that line? And you know, within BYU Idaho, there was always this kind of line that nobody was willing to cross, you know, that we're allowed to throw all this other stuff out, but there are these certain things that we aren't allowed to touch that are sacrosanct.
And what sorts of things were those?
Well, that like Jesus is the savior, that Adam was the first man, whatever that meant and however you interpreted that, and similar things, you know, the Book of Mormon was the word of God and things. And so I started to become a little bit concerned about that, but I guess I didn't dwell on it too much while I was there. But anyway, then I went to graduate school at the University of Wyoming, and that really is when things took off for me, is that I found myself being incredibly, or at least trying to be incredibly intellectually critical and thorough in one part of my life, but then kind of turning that off and compartmentalizing the other part of my life. And at one point, I just kind of asked myself the question of, could I be wrong? You know, am I going to believe despite everything that may, any evidence that may point the other direction? Or could I be wrong? And if so, what would it take to convince me to be wrong? And then it's a very non-linear transition, I think, out of faith. But some of the big things were, it was during one of the first arrests of Warren Jeffs, and I knew about some of Joseph Smith's polygamy. You know, my fifth great-grandmother was one of his polygamous wives, Lucy Walker, so that was always kind of alluded to within family tradition. So I knew about that, and I knew a little bit about how that took place. I remember at BYU Idaho, I went and hunted out In Sacred Loneliness from the library to learn a little bit more about Lucy Walker. So I knew that there was something a little bit suspect about the way he convinced these women to marry him. And so when Warren Jeffs got arrested, I was like, oh, well, what he's arrested for isn't that much unlike what I understand Joseph Smith's polygamy to be like. Mm-hmm. Why am I critical of Warren Jeffs and not critical of Joseph Smith? And then it was just kind of a deluge of things and problems. And I think the Book of Abraham really drove the nail in the coffin. I said, well, if there is almost one empirical test of Joseph Smith's prophetic power, this is it, you know? This, and in my mind, DNA and the Lamanites and things like that, you know, that's as close to as empirical as we can get. If I don't digest this evidence and in my mind am honest to this evidence, then in my mind I'm not being intellectually rigorous. That's kind of how things spiraled out of control. I guess the other thing that I want to add is that while I was, you know, in this downward spiral and losing faith, you know, not only did I come to Holly and talk to her about it, but I reached out to many what I would consider intellectual Mormons for discussion and help. Back at BYU Idaho, some of my geology professors, and back in Los Alamos. And I never got what I felt was satisfying answers. And so at some point, I just let it go, you know?
So during this time, did you let Holly in on what you were feeling all along the way, or did you hold it in and for fear of what might happen if she knew you were doubting?
I was definitely scared of what might happen. I mean, when I told her the first time, you know, I was fearful that all of a sudden divorce would be thrown on the table. But I had let her know pretty early on. I don't know if it was right away, but it was really early in the process.
It was pretty early. And when he told me, I mean, it wasn't like a yelling match or anything. I mean, it was really sobering. We both held each other and cried a long time.
It was just a traumatic, sad experience, an emotional experience for both of us.
So Holly, how were you reacting to what he was telling you? Did you feel like, well, he must be doing some sort of sin, or were you more worried about now what happens to my family and my eternal goals and all that? What was your reaction to what he told you?
It was more of with my family, like the reaction. I didn't know how he was going to react to us since we were believing still. And I was just kind of really worried about our dynamic. But the thing is like, I felt like everything was going to be fine. You know, the whole Mormon mindset, like, it's the truth. He's going to come back because it's the truth. Like, he'll come back. No big deal. I definitely had days where it was sad and I was angry. And I was really angry that he would do that to our family. But I never thought of divorce. I never brought that to my mind. I would never allow myself to get to there, to that point.
Because you thought I'd come back someday.
Yeah. And if later in life he came back, and I'd feel like a big douchebag.
So he said that he told you pretty early on. How did you guys negotiate, like, church attendance? Did you keep going, Clay?
Oh, he came and he conquered.
I came most of the time, and I continued attending.
Just to
and
save
then slowly that attending turned to just attending sacrament, and then slowly that turned into kind of intermittently on and off, and then not. But I did attend for a really long time. And I did things that I was really uncomfortable with. Like, I blessed our son that was born, and I was already a non-believer.
And that didn't bother me because I've been hearing from other women that if a man had the priesthood and he blessed a baby, then the baby wouldn't...
It would be honored.
It would still be honored, I guess.
Well, yeah, they kind of have to go with that idea that the ordinance sticks even if the person performing it isn't worthy, because if they don't, that's a huge nightmare.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, I continued attending. I did, some things that I wasn't comfortable with. At some point, I told my bishop that I would no longer accept callings.
That was after we moved, though.
Oh, that was in Wyoming.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, because that's when they gave me the Cub Scout calling or whatever.
And they gave him a Cub Scout master calling.
Yeah.
Which was kind of funny.
But I tried to attend the best I could.
You were on the New Order Mormon website, right?
Yeah.
And did you try to use that as a way to balance being an active Mormon with non-belief?
Yeah, absolutely. I drew support from that forum, and that, a lot of those people are in the same situation. And I still firmly believe that, in our lives, we sometimes have to sacrifice things for the greater good. And in my mind, our marriage, I still loved Holly dearly. I loved my kids dearly, and I didn't want to lose that. Or I just didn't even want to make that environment unhappy. And so, yeah, that board helped give support and direction and kind of this nuanced kind of middle road path.
And Clay actually sent me to Faces East. Is that the website?
Yeah,
But I never really got into that. So.
Yeah.
So your activity started to trail off. And Holly, were you continuing to go and be the believing wife with these kids you got to raise as that was happening?
I took them to church every Sunday and I did my calling, I guess.
So you guys spent at least a couple of years, a few years, as an interfaith or an interfaith couple.
Right.
Yep.
How did you negotiate that? Did you do it purposefully where you sat down and had conversations about boundaries or expectations, or did you just kind of go with the flow and feel your way through it?
I kind of made it kind of it's my way kind of thing, right? Don't you think that I did that?
Yeah, I feel like a lot of it was kind of go with the flow.
Yeah, but I took them to church every Sunday. I made sure that they...
Well, yeah, but there was never an instance where I said, I'm not going to church, and you said, damn straight, you're going to church, we never got into those, right?
But what about, the kids? Did you feel like, well, you may not believe, but the kids will be raised Mormon, and you're not going to undermine that?
Well, we kind of had an understanding that they would go to church when they were younger, and then they could figure it out later on.
Yeah, but that was a big worry for me, Heather, is that, Holly always thought... Oh, well, he'll come back someday and it will be okay. And internally, I was like, what am I going to do when these kids become 8 years old? And how are we going to do this for the long haul? Mm-hmm. I was devoted to keeping and making things work, but I had no clue on how that would be sustainable over decades. I feel like we kind of felt our way through it. I wouldn't discuss crazy Mormon topics unless I was asked about my feelings about certain things, or if I expressed something and Holly expressed interest in those things, then I would talk about them, but I wouldn't come home and just, blast whatever I had read that day or whatever. But by no means was I a compliant non-negotiating person. You know, I started drinking alcohol during that time.
That was a debacle.
And coffee and did you things bring those, like that.
Did you bring those things into the home?
Oh, no, he did not.
So there was...
I think that was kind of the underwritten rule that I could drink at social events that I was at, but I wouldn't bring beer into the house. But that slowly slipped by. Like, I would bring alcohol into the home to cook with, but uh-oh, one fell down my throat, you know?
Okay, so it wasn't like one day Holly came home and opened the fridge and ta-da, there's Budweiser. Or
No. And I had told her when I decided to drink, I told her about it. And we talked about things, but I mean, I don't know how we made it work because it's not like we ever had solid, intense conversations about boundaries and expectations. Neither were we just completely silent about it. We just kind of muddled our way through it, and there was kind of a mutual understanding that I was going to do certain things, but I would refuse to do other things. And,
well, the thing is like I always felt like Clay is definitely an individual person. I can't control him in any ways.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to make his own decisions, and I couldn't tell him that he couldn't drink if he wanted to drink.
At some point, I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say there was, you know, being in academia, Heather, and people may lambast me and say how much of an idiot I am. I did think about how romantic it would be for me to smoke pipe every once in a while, you know, a tobacco pipe.
And, I put the kibosh on that, though.
Holly told me that was a deal breaker. That was one conversation where we had, she's just like, this is not going to happen. The end. So
I could see you smoking a pipe.
Right? Exactly. I still think that it would be glorious in some way, but I can understand mouth cancer and other things are not good. So I've conceded into not smoking pipe, but I still have fantasies about it in my mind.
So at some point, things changed for you as well, Holly, right?
Yeah, I actually, like, things just added on the shelf. I talked to Clay a little bit about Relief Society lessons, and I'd be, like, all snarky about it. And then one summer, I wanted what?
Well, I don't want to interrupt you, but Proposition 8 was a big deal for both of us as well. And that was a huge... I was already out of the church, but that gave me reason to actually take a stand against certain things. And I think that was...
That also, yeah, it actually was the first big thing that I said, the prophets are wrong about this. This is not right. So, but then, put stuff on my shelf. And after we moved to...
Houston for a summer,
Clay, I wanted to understand Clay because I just was at a loss, I guess. He handed me this book called The Insider's View of Mormon Origins.
Oh, goodness. I just finished. I just finished reading that book. And I am a non-believer for a couple of years now. And I'm reading the book going, oh, come on. Like, this is so obvious now, you know?
Right. Yeah. So I'm reading this and I'm like, Clay, have you heard anything about the book of Isaiah and the Kinderhook plates? And he's like, come on, Holly. I told you this so long ago. Weren't you listening to me? And it just kind of clicked in my mind. I was just like, this is just ridiculous. Like, maybe Joseph Smith was inspired to write the Book of Mormon. That's where I was going at that time, that he might have been just inspired instead of having the real gold plates. But I just was like, this is just horrible. Later on, like, I was called in the Young Women's, and they told me that I needed to hand out a Book of Mormon, and I couldn't do it. And I told them, and I said, I can't hand out this Book of Mormon. They're like, what? You can't hand out a Book of Mormon? And I'm like, yeah, I just don't believe in it. And I got sent to the bishop, and the bishop I talked to the bishop for a long time, and I said, you got to release me. I can't tell these girls that I believe all these things if I can't even hand out a Book of Mormon. And so then they released me, and they tried to have me read the Book of Mormon again. They said, what did they say? They said, oh, well, you just need to read the Book of Mormon. Try to read the Book of Mormon and then see how you feel about it. And I'm like, that doesn't discredit anything that I read about, like, the Kinderhook plates or the Book of Isaiah. So then it was kind of broke open from there, and then haven't been back since.
Okay. So how did you tell Clay? How did you let him know all this was over?
I had an open dialogue with him pretty much the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
He was just shaking his head when I was, like, telling him about the book, like, The Insider's View of Mormon Origins. He's like, I told you all of this stuff before. You were not listening to me.
But when it finally all broke apart, Clay, did you like do a jig?
Not openly, but internally, I think I did. But I tried to, I mean, she was still, when she first, you know, started reading this stuff and just kind of, you know, it was really painful for her as well. And so I think because it happened so long ago for me, we kind of forget about how painful the process is. Mm-hmm. And she was at another loss about how she wanted to proceed. And we still, you know, we still don't know exactly how we want to proceed in life about certain things. And we've got to figure that stuff out. But yeah, inside I was really, really happy about it. Outside I was vocally trying to reassure her that, you know, you don't need to make big decisions right now. Mm-hmm. Go slow. Well, I'll support you in whatever decision you want to do.
Like once I found out, I was like, I gotta tell everyone that I don't believe anymore. And he's like, just go, try it out, try to see if you could still go to church. Because I was devastated. I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, it was just horrible.
Yeah, and she'd say like, "Oh, I think I want to try to go to church again," and I'd say, "Yeah, you should go do it." And then she'd come home and say, "That was the worst experience ever."
Never gonna happen again.
I'm assuming that at some point you guys told your families about what was going on or got out.
I have.
And I have told some of my family. I haven't told my parents yet. I just can't do it. My family's more of a closed family. They kind of pretend things aren't going on. And so I'm trying to figure out if it's the best way to go about it, what the best way is to go about it. Mm-hmm. But I don't know quite yet. But I have siblings that I've told and friends.
And so what is the how has that affected your relationships? What has the response been?
For my parents, it's been tough. You know, I mean, like I said, I think there's already in my family a culture of not living up to expectations and living under some degree of criticism. And that's just been amplified times 10. Having said that, my parents didn't disown me or anything like that.
I do want to say this. Clay was the golden child. And then after this,
then I'm nothing, right?
He's nothing. Yeah.
It's true.
He was the golden child.
Yeah, because both of my younger siblings are, you know, estranged from the church. And mm-hmm.
And the older sibling is not really a traditional TBM.
Well, she is, but I feel like her relationship with my parents is strained sometime. Mm-hmm. I mean, she is not traditional TBM, but she is traditional enough to...
It's not an issue in that relationship.
Yeah, it's not an issue mm-hmm. there, but I feel like there are certain things that are strained, and so...
Well, she gets the brunt end of everything that happens in the family.
But anyway, so no, I agree with that. I think my parents really maybe were proud of me, and then all of a sudden, you know, I'm just like, oh, now he's an apostate too. It's been tough. I mean, it's obviously visits are awkward at sometimes, and there are difficult conversations, and
somehow they like to talk to me about things, but not Clay. Yeah. So it's kind of
awkward.
But with my family, I tried talking to my little brother about gay marriage, and he almost had a heart attack. Mm-hmm. So I stopped the topic. But
I do think my parents blame me for our apostate family. That even though my parents know that Holly isn't going to church and doesn't believe a lot of things, that I feel like they feel like I let my family down.
Well, you're the head of your household.
Yeah, and I was the one to first leave as well. And
yeah.
I think maybe they think that Holly just couldn't handle the pressure of trying to raise the kids Mormon, so she left too or something.
Right. Sorry, I had a big eye roll right then. I couldn't see it.
So tell me about life now. Clave said that you've ended up an atheist. Did that happen pretty quickly after you quit believing in the literalness of the gospel?
Yeah, I felt like not right away, but definitely fairly rapidly. I tried to hold on to a more nuanced belief of religion and God. But in the end, you know, I felt like if I apply the same critical thinking and the same consistent standards of what I'm going to accept as as reliable data and not reliable data. I felt like the entire New Testament fell apart. All of Christianity fell apart. And in the end, I just felt like I was trying to nuance God to a point where God didn't really mean anything anymore. You know, we can say that God is rainbows, but what does that matter? You know, and so at some point, I mean, not that I really said God is rainbows, but I felt like God was becoming so nuanced that he really had no bearing on my life anymore. And fairly rapidly, I adopted a worldview without God.
Okay, and how about you, Holly?
I'm just trying to grasp the whole situation outside of church, but right now, I do believe in God, and I'm really trying to hold on to beliefs that I still have. And I'm trying to search out different things, but really, I've been taking a break. I don't want to think about it right now. It's just too mind-boggling. So
you still kind of have an interfaith marriage then?
Right.
Yeah, definitely. Interfaith, but not necessarily interreligious anymore.
But it's kind of nice because our kids might ask a question and we're like, oh, one person, someone might think this or, and that's, they kind of come and.
Yeah, we try to kind of tell them that people disagree and have different viewpoints and some things we know, you know, our daughter's learning math and we say, you know, some things everybody objectively knows, like 2 + 2 = 4, you know, to 4, but other things people disagree on, and then she just ignores us and gets bored. So it doesn't do any good. But.
Right. And are you still taking the same approach to your marriage, just kind of feeling your way through it, not really setting any expectations or anything like that?
Well, I think there are expectations in that we want to be loyal to each other and loyal to our kids and loyal to our family. But are you talking in more like prayer and things like that, Heather?
Or behavioral expectations? Or is there any contention over whether or not God exists?
No, I think it's more of a open kind of understanding. Just trying to really,
Yeah, see, Heather, you're discovering that we have poor communication skills.
No, we have good communication skills. It's just that we kind of just respect the other person's viewpoint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A little bit.
Okay. So has your marriage changed at all after the loss of faith?
I feel definitely. Like we've come a lot closer.
Yeah, we can definitely talk about more things. We don't have to worry about offending the other one so much, you know, or bringing up contentious dialogues. I think that we can make more and better friends because there isn't the stigma of non-LDS friends or LDS friends. It's more just kind of, you know, whoever we feel good with.
Yeah, because before that was really hard because I had a lot of LDS friends and you never connected with any of them.
Or I was always viewed as the apostate within those circles.
Right.
And I feel like we're less busy with church, and so we have more time to spend with each other and our kids. I mean, definitely behavioral things like alcohol and things like that are no longer issues. I think there are behavioral expectations that neither of us want to do anything that betrays the trust of, you know, of the other person or the kids, you know, like
being kind to each other and trying to serve each other.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have to be Mormon to be a good spouse, person. I guess.
So I've received a little bit of criticism for having on so many stories of couples who weather faith crises and move on in their marriage and are happy afterwards. And I think the reason that those stories are easy to get is that it's easy to talk about those things. And if your marriage fell apart, there's a lot of stuff that maybe isn't ideal to put on a podcast for your ex to listen to and that kind of thing.
Or even like to get them together for like both sides of the story or whatever.
Exactly. It's a more difficult interview to do. So, and
said that though, we are surrounded by friends who
had that happen.
Their marriage has split apart because of the Mormon issue. And that's incredibly hard for us to see. You know, that's, we know many people.
Yeah. It's heartbreaking
that has happened too. And I think we're a little bit lucky and I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's heartbreaking just to see them both in a situation before they get divorced. And then afterwards, it's still heartbreaking, but it's nice to see them separated as well because they aren't bogged down with each other.
I don't think it's something that you can classify as this is the cause or this is the reason or whatever. But I sometimes wonder if a marriage is more likely to break up in the face of a disaffection because of the terms in which they were entered. Do you guys feel like, withstanding the religious aspects, you cared about each other as individuals and were friends with each other? And so there, it was more than just like, this is a salvation vessel for me to get to the celestial kingdom. This person plays this role in my religious life. Do you feel like there was more there in your marriage, so that when the Mormon stuff fell away, it wasn't as tough of an impact on your relationship?
Definitely think so. In my mind, that even though I left the church, yeah, I was still friends with Holly. I still cared about Holly. I still wanted to be there for her.
Well, the thing is that I think if Clay would have came to me and said, hey, I'm not going to church and you just have to deal with it, I think I would have reacted way differently.
Yeah.
The only way I reacted this way is because Clay was so sincere and like he really showed me his emotions, and I just couldn't handle seeing him that way.
Well, is there anything that you guys wanted to talk about in the episode that we didn't cover?
Holly? I kind of want to say a caveat to my parents if they ever hear this before I tell them. I just want to say, like, I don't even know what I want to say. I just want to say I'm sorry that I'm letting you down and that I wish it was true, but I can't believe it. So I'm sorry that I'm causing you pain. So that's all I can say.
I think I've thought a lot about why I'm motivated to participate in Mormon Expositor. And by no means do I believe in Mormonism or do I believe in God. And by no means would it hurt my feelings or make me sad if people decide that they no longer believe and leave the church, especially if that's an improvement to their lives. But at the same time, I have no motivations to tear down the church. There are things that I wish I could tear down, like the church supporting what I view as bigoted legislation and things like that. But by no means do I necessarily want to tear down the church. Instead, I like to have conversations with diverse, interesting people that come to a conversation prepared to talk about a topic. And I feel like a lot of times online, I'm not able to do that in the way that I want to do that. And that the Mormon Expositor podcast gives me an opportunity to do that. And it's fun. I enjoy it. So I think those are my motivations.
Yeah, I think our group has, if you talk to the different people, they have different motivations. And
sure.
I don't think, with the exception of maybe one person, I don't think we really care if people stay in the church or leave the church. We just really like talking about the church.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I don't know about you, but when I no longer believed, Mormonism became infinitely more fascinating than when I believed in it.
Yeah, because you're allowed to ask questions that you didn't feel allowed to ask prior to leaving, right? Yep.
So overall, leaving Mormonism was a positive change in your lives?
I definitely think that overall it was a positive change in mine.
So far.
And I felt another big thing, though, is I feel like it's a positive change for our kids. And that we're making a difficult and heart-wrenching decision at times, at other times very liberating and joyful decision, but we're making that decision so hopefully our kids don't have to make that decision. And, you know, maybe they will have to make that decision. Maybe they'll want to be involved in Mormonism when they're older, and that's fine and whatever. But I really felt the responsibility that I didn't want my kids to grow up and have to break a link that I could have broken in my life that I felt like it was a good link to break.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who say, well, if you raise your kids with this notion that they can just choose religion when they get older, they won't choose any religion at all. But I kind of look at it as you're giving them the opportunity to opt in to something that puts a lot of requirements on their life, and they're a lot freer to make that choice than they would be if they were indoctrinated from the time they were little to just accept something.
Absolutely.
Plus, it's giving them more freedom and less guilt.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, thanks for coming on. I've really enjoyed interviewing you and getting to hear your voice, Holly, and find out your story. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Yep.
You think I should be? No, I'm standing here at the end of who I once was, not sure yet of who I will become. Oh, but I'm feeling brave, I got nothing. got nothing to lose. I'm feeling beautiful as I make no excuse. And I move to the edge and I take my great leap. It doesn't matter if I fall, 'cause leaps and falls make me a better me.
Directing, producing, and editing was done by Heather C. And the theme music was provided by McCall Erickson. Thank you for listening. Mormon Expression Voices is a production of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Find us on the web at whitefieldseducational.org. The Mormon Expression and Mormon Expression Voices podcasts, as well as other educational initiatives, are made possible by your generous donations. Please consider a subscription today.